So let's begin and let me refresh your memory. We are in the middle of a really, really fascinating, astonishing Agadita. It's a fairly long one, so we ended up splitting it in two. So I'll refresh the memory of those who were here and bring those who weren't here last time up to date. The Agadita begins with a person who asked Rav a question, a shaila, and he was very chuspidik in his response to Rav. In turn, Rav Kahana, who was a Talmud and was sitting there, broke his neck, which is a pretty aggressive thing to do, I have to say. So Rav supports Rav Kahana's action on grounds that this person would have been a Moser, and a Moser is equivalent of a Rodef. That's one way to understand Rav. So he's Chayav Misa, and you have to protect the life of a Jew whom this person, the Shoal, is going to endanger. But he says, in any case, you need to leave Bavel because the current rule in Bavel were rigorous about capital punishment, and he was endangered. Life was in danger. So you need to escape to Eretz Yisrael. And he said, go to Eretz Yisrael, and you need to do one thing, and that is you need to make sure that for 7 years you remain silent and sheer, and don't ask any questions. So Rav Kahana goes to Eretz Yisrael, and of course he goes to the best yeshiva there. It wasn't Brisk, as it happens, but it was Rav Yochanan's yeshiva in Tveria, and he goes into the Beis Medrash, and we get this wonderful vivid vignettes of life in Rabbi Yochanan's yeshiva. Rabbi Yochanan had just finished the shir. Reish Lakish was being, and had left. Reish Lakish had just finished reviewing the shir for the Talmidim. Reish Lakish was kind of like a Talmud chaver of Rabbi Yochanan, and he was almost like a co-Rosh Yeshiva, almost. And so after Rabbi Yochanan, the main Rosh Yeshiva, gave the shir, he would leave, and Reish Lakish, his close Talmud chaver, would repeat it for the Talmidim. And he had just finished that, and Rav Kahana walks in, and he says, where's Reish Lakish? And the Talmidim say, why do you want to know where Reish Lakish is? And in any case, he asks, Reish Lakish tells him the shir, and Rav Kahana slugs it up. That is to say, he says a shir, he asks a kasha, shir, kasha, shir, kasha, shir, kasha. Rav Kahana bombs away at a sugya that he obviously hadn't prepared, because he didn't know what they were learning. So I mentioned this last time, and it reminds me of Sachs, who, like, wherever he goes, he can, like, start talking and learning about anything. Not that he's so aggressive, but he just knows the same. Sort of kind of was like that. He knew everything. So Reish Lakish, in turn, after this encounter, goes to Rabbi Yochanan, his Rebbe, and says, Ari Olam Ibavel, there's this, like, lion, tremendous Talmud Chacham, fierce learner who has just come up from Bavel, and prepare your shir for tomorrow well. You need to be prepared for this. So Rabbi Yochanan takes the message, comes back, no doubt prepared, gives the shir, and Rav Kahana is seated in the front row. We discussed this last time. In the yeshiva, in Rabbi Yochanan's yeshiva and other yeshivas like that, there was a radical hierarchy amongst Talmidim. And the better you were, you sat up front. Weaker guys sat all the way in the back. And it was constantly fluid and dynamic. You ask a clutch kasha, you go in the back. You ask a good kasha, you move up. It's constant change, like musical chairs, which, as I pointed out, is a pretty tense environment to be in. You're constantly up, down. Where do I stand? Who's making the decisions? How do you... embarrassing. But, of course, it brings out the best in people. It's a highly competitive environment. In any case, Rav Kahana was seated in front. As Rabbi Yochanan is giving the shir and Rav Kahana is silent, he keeps on getting demoted. Row, 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 until he ends up in the back. So Rav Kahana is like, you can imagine him, like this fierce, aggressive, incredible Talmud Chacham has 1,000 things to say. He's like, you can imagine the struggle. He has to hold himself back and finally can't handle it anymore. Even after he's been demoted all the way into the back, he says, Yehei Rava HaKadosh Baruch Hu, let every row that I was demoted be the equivalent of 1 year of silence that Rav told me I have to be silent for. 7 year silence, 7 rows, I'm ready to go. So Rabbi Yochanan repeats the shir, and Kasha Teres, Kasha Teres, Kasha Teres, and Rav Kahana now gets promoted from row to row with every good Kasha. And astonishingly, Rav Yochanan gets demoted because he's sitting on seven pillows. So every time Rav Kahana asks a good question, somebody pulls away a pillow from Rav Yochanan. That's what the Gemara says. Now, the Maral says it's not literal, and I brought the Maral with me because he has a non-literalist reading of this whole Agadita, which is, I think, helpful in some ways. So it doesn't mean literally they pulled away the pillows, because that would be like, can you imagine? This great Rosh Hashiva, Rav Yochanan, the reigning Talmud Chacham and Eretz Yisrael, can you imagine Talmud like pulling away his pillows? It's like hard to believe. So it seems likely to me that Rav Maral's reading is a good reading. And he shrunk in the estimation of his Talmidim, because this kind of kept asking his kashas, and he didn't answer them, and so he shrunk. So he was on the bottom, and Rav Kahana was all the way up on top. And that's where we were up to. So look at the Daf Kuf Yud Zayin Amud Aleph, third line from the bottom. And by the way, if you want to, those of you who weren't here last time can listen and get the whole shiur, so you'll be fully up to date in all the things we discussed, which were many. But that's the basic outline of what happens. So, third line from the bottom, Rabbi Yochanan Gavra Saba Hava. Rabbi Yochanan wasn't, everybody have it? Rabbi Yochanan was an older man at this time. Umisarche Gvine. And his eyebrows were very long. I guess some old men, I haven't seen this too frequently, but some old men have long eyebrows. Have you seen that? I don't know. But his eyebrows, have you seen that? No? I guess if you don't trim your eyebrows, maybe. Be all that as it may, he had very long eyebrows, and he couldn't see well. So he couldn't see who this Talmud was. Amar Luhu, so he said to them, to his either Shamashim or Talmidim, Dalu li einai v'achsiye. Pull these away from my eyes so that I can see who's asking me all these kashas. Dalu le b'machalta de kaspa. They took out a silver comb and they combed away his eyebrows. So that's interesting. Like, what's with the silver comb? Why does the Gemara mention it? The Baal Agada to mention that it was a silver comb? Why is it relevant? What's with the eyes being covered? Why couldn't he do it himself? Yeah, right, just move him away. So what this bespeaks is the extraordinary stature and wealth of Rabbi Yochanan. He's an establishment figure. He is the Rosh Yeshiva. He, remember in the other Agadita we learned years ago, he was very, very poor. But once he became Rosh Yeshiva, they made him wealthy. And he was a person of enormous stature and prestige, and they knew how to support their Rosh Yeshivas, you know. So he had a silver comb, which was expensive, obviously, but bespoke his stature. What I think we have symbolized here is the idea that, on the one hand, Rabbi Yochanan couldn't see, which is to say that his vision wasn't only literally blocked, but it was figuratively blocked as well. That is, he couldn't see this newcomer, this Rav Kahana. He couldn't assess him. And as the Agadita unfolds, that blindness to Rav Kahana is what triggers the next tragic unfolding of the Agadita. He was limited in his vision. And he couldn't really see what Rav Kahana was about, and his kashas, his tiruchim, he didn't really get it. And I think the silver... comb is a reflection of his stature. Rav Kahana's an outsider. He's a newbie. He's come from Bavel. What's Bavel? We're in Eretz Yisrael. We are the center of Torah learning. Ki mitzion teitzei Torah. Tveria, Yerushalayim, originally with the Beis HaMikdash, who was the great Rebbe Yehuda Nasi, compiled the Mishnah. Rav Yochanan was a Talmud, a very junior Talmud of Rebbe Yehuda Nasi. Eretz Yisrael was the center of Torah learning. Who's this guy from Bavel? Like, so Rav Yochanan has this sense, not only of his own prestige, which was deserved, he was an incomparable Talmud Chacham, but the overall prestige of Eretz Yisrael against a newbie whom he couldn't quite see, and what's this Bavel, and why is he asking me questions? So there's a kind of blindness to Rav Kahana, to the new person, to Bavel, and an elevation of the stature of Rabbi Yochanan. As we will see, as I understand the Agadita as it unfolds, that becomes a crucial fulcrum in this unfolding of this whole story. So I'm mentioning it to you now because I think it illuminates what will eventually occur. Yes?
My thought is that could be also, not only is he unable to perceive Rav Kahana, but he's also figuratively blindsided by the person who was quiet for so long, and all of a sudden he's just like, now boomeranging questions at him.
Good. I like that. Blindsided. He really couldn't. He wasn't expecting this. Yeah. Great. Excellent. Thank you. Okay. So now, the story unfolds. If you think this is interesting, wait till you see how it unfolds. It's just remarkable. So, Chaza departe svase, safvase. So he saw that Rav Kahana's lips were spread, savar achuch kamachayech be. So he thought that Rav Kahana was smiling at him. What's that? That could be, but that's not what Rashi says. I'll tell you in a second. But he saw what he perceived to be Rav Kahana smiling at him, and he took that to be an affront.
Yeah.
Like if Kahana, this young guy from Bavel, is like laughing at him because he's asking all these kashas and Rabbi Yochanan didn't have all the answers sorted out well or satisfactorily. So he thought Rav Kahana is making fun of him. Chalash daite. So Rav Yochanan had chalishas das, however you want to translate that. He was upset, he was angry. And noch nafshe. Rav Kahana dies. Rav Kahana, who murdered the guy who affronted Rav, broke the guy's neck, kind of a midah keneged midah, maybe. Rav Kahana himself dies, but Rav Yochanan is responsible for Rav Kahana's death. Isn't that astonishing? Does this remind you of any other instance where Rav Yochanan was responsible for the death of a great man? Exactly, Reish Lakish. Remember, they had this tragic misunderstanding, and as to what Rabbi Yochanan Reish Lakish meant in a repartee between the two of them, and Rabbi Yochanan got very upset. Chalash daite, the same phrase. Chalash Reish Lakish, chalash daite Rabbi Yochanan, and Reish Lakish dies. Same encounter. And maybe eventually we'll look at the deeper parallels between the two. But here you have Rabbi Yochanan being responsible, in some sense, for the death of two of the greatest Amoraim. So that's, need to absorb that. We need to figure that out. That's hard to understand, to say the least. But let's see. So a couple of comments. So first of all, what's with this? Why did he have this smile? So look at Rashi, which is so interesting. You'll see the last Rashi on the Amud. Partes Vasei. Rashi has different gears than the Gemara, actually. Nikra Asvaso Ayide Maka. He got banged up. Somebody punched him in the mouth. Which is maybe not surprising, given how pugilistic Rav Kahana was. I mean, remember, he broke the other guy's neck. Somebody punched him in the mouth. That's what Rashi says. Could have been a cleft chin. A cleft lip, which is what I would have thought had I seen the Gemara without Rashi, but that's what Rashi understands it. I don't know. Maybe Rashi had never seen cleft lips. I don't know. I don't know if Rav Kahana had a cleft lip. I don't really know. But he had something, and that's what Rashi interprets it, which is interesting. And it's interesting also that if you think about it, Rav Kahana's moral challenges were with his mouth. He was very verbally aggressive in asking kashas and Reish Lakish, asking kashas and Rabbi Yochanan, right? Is it not poetic justice or midah keneged midah that he have a makah bepeh? And is it not poetic justice or midah keneged midah that Rabbi Yochanan, who failed to see, in some sense, who Rav Kahana truly was, because he ended up killing him, that he had a problem with his sight? So we have a double entendre, a double meaning of sight and speech, their efficacy, their danger in sight, if you can't see, the danger in speech, if you don't speak properly, and the respect in which eyes and mouths can be deformed, correlated to the possible moral deformity in lack of sight or in aggressive speech. Okay, so let's see how it continues. So how is Rabbi Yochanan going to react to this? I mean, if it were you, how would you react to it? I mean, I would probably feel really awful. I mean, even though Rabbi Yochanan didn't, you know, intentionally kill him, but nevertheless, he was in some sense responsible for his death. So how do you think? So here's how the Agadah continues. L'machar amaluhu Rabbi Yochanan l'Rabbanan. Rabbi Yochanan the next day said to the Rabbanan, the Bnei HaYeshiva, Chazisu l'bavla heichi avid? Did you see what this Babylonian person did? Notice he calls him Bavla. He doesn't call him by his name. He calls him by his geographic origin, where he's from, Bavel. And I think that's very significant, as we'll see. He's from Bavel. And we are from Eretz Yisrael. And so not just what he did, but given their answer, it could be also, well, no, let me react. Heichi avid, I think, means with respect to the smile. You see what he did? He was laughing at me. So he was, in effect, seeking support from the Rabbanan and the Beis Medrash to his upset, which resulted in Rav Kahana's death. Do you see what he did? As if to say, don't blame me. I mean, he was laughing at me. That's the way I read it. Does that seem like a reasonable reading to you? So, Amrulay, so they said to him, Darke hache. He just has a deformity in his mouth. He wasn't laughing at you. Don't blame him. You misinterpreted this entirely. You misunderstood this entirely. Exactly, by the way, like the misunderstanding between Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish and that other Agadata, where Rabbi Yochanan misunderstood Reish Lakish's comment. Here, Rabbi Yochanan misinterpreted or misunderstood what appeared to be a smile of Rav Kahana, which really wasn't. So there was a failure in both cases on Rabbi Yochanan's part to understand the words or condition of another person. So, Rabbi Yochanan was an incredible gadol. Let's remember this. He was a gadol she'ein kamohu. He was one of the greatest Jews who ever lived. Talmidei Chachamim, gadolim. I mean, he was a great... Let's remember this. As I said the last time, the author of this Agadata is teaching us something. We can never enter into the inner space of Rabbi Yochanan or of Kahana. These are great, great people who lived different times, and they were incredibly great. We can't fathom their greatness. But the author of this Agadata wanted to teach us something. So we're trying to figure out what the author of the Agadata wanted to teach us. And the author of the Agadata has Rabbi Yochanan feeling very bad about this. Not surprisingly, given the gadol that he was. Al lagabe ma'arasa. So Rabbi Yochanan went to the cave where Rav Kahana was buried. So obviously burial had already taken place, and he's buried in a cave, which is of course common in those days. There were people buried in caves. So he went to the cave. Presumably, and I think that that's the way they got it unfolds, to seek forgiveness, to reconcile. Because now he realizes that Rav Kahana didn't intend to make fun of him. Okay. Chaza davahadro le'achna. So he saw that there was a snake which rolled itself up in front of the cave and made entrance into the cave possible. Let's look at the top Rashi so you can see how Rashi understands it. Nachash gadol asa atzmo. Nachash gadol, a great snake, Asa Asma Kagalgav made itself like a circle, Umakif Espia Ma'ara, and surrounded the entrance to the cave. Venosain Zinovol Atok Piv, and he put his tail into his mouth. Ain Adam Yachol Likones, and no person could enter. So that's, I mean, as a matter of literal fact, not implausible. I mean, it's possible there was a snake in front of the cave. I mean, there are snakes, there are caves. So far, the Agadata makes good literal sense. Okay? However, as we'll see, as the Agadata continues, it seems to leave the world of the reality, at least that we know, and enter into a different space. So, Amale, Rav Yochanan says to the snake, Achna, Achna, Pesach, Pumech. Snake, snake, open your mouth. V'ikones, ikones harav etzel talmud. And let the master go before the student. So here, as I say, this seems to be a little bit removed from the real world that we know, because most people don't talk to snakes. So what we're going to need to try to do is figure out what is this, at least, Mendy, don't most people not talk to snakes?
Or? I think Harry Potter did, but that's fine.
Right. So I mean, I'm going to step back and try to understand this overall scene and what is this all about, what's happening. But let's, you know, read it for starters. So he says, let the Rav go to the Talmud. Interesting that Rabbi Yochanan says that in the first place. Like, why doesn't he just say, let me in? Why does he say, Rav Eitzel Talmud? But let's continue. V'lo pasach. Didn't go in. He didn't let him in. So he changed the formula, Rabbi Yochanan. Yikanes chaver Eitzel chaver. Let a colleague or friend come to a colleague. What has he just done? He lowered his own stature and elevated the stature of Kahan. It's no longer Rav and Talmud, it's Chaver Chaver. V'lo Pasach! Rav Yochanan has not yet mastered the code that would allow the snake to unlock the cave. So what is his next attempt? Yikanes Talmud Eitzel Harav. Let the student come to the master, Pasachle, and he opens. So the code for Rabbi Yochanan to gain entrance to Rav Kahana's burial was to diminish himself below the level of Rav Kahana. This is like before the Talmidim took away the pillows, and Rav Yochanan was sitting in the first row, Rav Kahana was sitting in the first row, Rav Yochanan had dropped all the way to the bottom. Now we have Rav Yochanan's need to internalize and accept that shift in stature. It happened, sort of, but now he has to internalize it. He has to accept that Rav Kahana is this Bavloi, whom he called him, is superior to him in stature, and that works. In effect, he's snipping off the eyebrows. He's getting a clearer vision of this relative stature of Rav Kahana and himself, which is very impressive in Rabbi Yochanan. I mean, think about Rabbi Yochanan is the Rosh Yeshiva of the most important yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael, in Tveria, and the Gadol Hador in Eretz Yisrael, which is the center of Torah learning, and this young whippersnapper, Kaviyachol, if you don't mind my using those terms, comes in from Bavel, and he has to acknowledge that he is inferior to this Rav Kahana, who was a Talmud of Rav. Rav was a somewhat senior colleague of Rabbi Yochanan, a little bit older than Rabbi Yochanan. Rav Kahana was a generation below. And he's got to admit that he is, and he does. Isn't that oppressive? It's very hard to do that. Imagine, you know, Rosh Yeshiva in a great, you know, in great Yeshiva, Rosh Yeshiva Panovich, and some young guy comes from, you know, Queens, and he asks him 28 kashas, and he has to now admit that this young guy from Queens is a better, bigger Talmud Chacham than Rashi Yochanan. It's like, how can you do that? Yochanan is an amazing, it's amazing that he's able to do this. In any case, so, Rav Khan is dead. Kind of hard to have a conversation with somebody who is dead, even though he had a conversation with a snake, but at least the snake was alive.
Harry Potter did that also.
What's that?
Harry Potter did that also.
Okay, there you go. Yeah. Maybe the author of Harry Potter read this Agadah. By Rachme v'ukme. So he sought Rachmanis from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, he davened to Hashem, and he resurrected him. Also pretty impressive. Of course, that's Minyana Dioma. What's the Minyana Dioma of that? This idea of one Amora resurrecting another Amora?
Oh, Purim.
Come Rabba Veshachte L'Rav Zera. So, when he was drunk. So, apparently... Excuse me? Yeah, so it's hard to know again exactly. We'll see. I mean, I'll come back and I'll try to interpret this, but... You know, Tehillat Mesim is like a pretty big miracle, so we need to understand that. But it's not just that. Now he has a conversation with him, now that he's alive. Amalei, I hava yadana d'darkei d'mar hachi l'chol shadati. Had I known that this, you weren't laughing at me, this is just a deformity that you have, I never would have felt so upset, offended. So he's in effect apologizing. He's saying, "I was a misunderstanding, and I really, what I did was really not right. I misunderstood what was happening." Lacey Mar Bahadan, come back with us. Okay, that's interesting. That's impressive because he's bringing his, you might say, young revolutionary, back into the base matters with him. Now, if Rav Khanna was so successful in schlugging him up, you know the Yiddish expression schlug him up? You know, like ask kashas, which he couldn't really answer. Schlug means to hit. So, isn't it impressive? I mean, let's think about the godless of Rabbi Yochanan, that he invites him now back in the Beis Medrash. He's inviting the one person in the entire Eretz Yisrael now who is capable of showing him up. Inviting him back into the Beis Medrash. Real godless under Yochanan's part. I mean, I find it very, very inspiring that he could do that. Very hard to do. So, he answers, Rav Khanna's answer is very puzzling. It's hard to understand. And Rashi has two Lashonos. So we're going to look at, to explain it. Two very different explanations of Rav Khanna's response. Rav Khanna says, if you can succeed in seeking Rachmanis, in beseeching Hashem that I will never die again, in other words, that I will become immortal, Azlina, then I'll go with you. Elo, but if you can't guarantee me immortality, lo Azlina, I'm not going.
Immortality doesn't mean that you won't kill me.
It sounds like I will never die again. Sulo shachim. It doesn't say you won't kill me. It just says I won't die again. It's possible, but it sounds like he was asking. I think the simplest reading, you may be right, but at the simplest, he just doesn't want to die again. You know, death was not pleasant. He went through it once, and he's had it with death. He's okay with being dead, but the dying process apparently is something that he didn't want, and he's like, I'm okay.
Isn't that like against like a lot everything that we believe, all
of
that
versus all of the... Okay, so we have to look at Rashi, right? So we have to look at Rashi, and your reading is is a possible reading. So I don't think it's the simplest reading, but it's a possible reading. Let's look at Rashi. Rashi has two. Let's finish the another line of the Gemara because I didn't finish what he says. Hoil v'cholif shaita cholif. Once the time has passed, the time has passed. Okay, so let's look at Rashi. You see Rashi v'ilo. Now let's look at imatzis. Imatzis, let me buy. You see the Rashi? It's where the line, last line of the wide lines in Rashi. Actually, Rashi seems to imply your reading. Now that I think about it, Mendy, look at Rashi. Imas in barachman shulah shachivna I akshina lach azlina bahadach ve'emot eslecha ubeis medrash. So that I won't die in case I ask. This is what I think Rashi is saying, exactly as you were saying, Mendy. I won't die if I ask you kashis and I go with you in the base medrash. So Rashi, I think, is giving it your narrower reading that with specifically respect to our exchange. And here's what Rashi continues, says, so a good point, Mendy. V'lo ho'il v'chol of shaita. So there are two lashonis in Rashi. Let's do the first one and then the second one. V'israchish nisa v'lo elech ot imach. I'm not going with you. Shema tichos alai. Exactly like Rashi said before, Mendy implied. Maybe you'll get angry at me. But almost od pamacheris, and I'll die another time. Ela eilech lebeisi chai velo emod od etzlecha pet almost pamacheris. So here on this first lashon of Rashi, he remains alive and resurrected. And what the only thing he's objecting to is going back to the base medrash. I'm not going with you. I've had enough. I'm going home. So I don't have to deal with any possible further misunderstandings between you and me. That's the first Rashi, and in fact, he remains resurrected. The second Lashon and Rashi is the Istaba Farish, Ho'ol v'chol of shayta v'kibalti tsar misa lo akabel od pamacheres leilech mikan. This is the way I was reading it. Since I already experienced death once, I've had it, I'm not going through this again, I'm staying exactly where I am. So the difference between the two Lashonos and Rashi is whether or not, and I was reading the Gemara according to the second Lashon, whether or not he accepted Tchias HaMesim, he accepted resurrection. According to the first Lashon and Rashi, he did, and he went home so as not to have any further possible misunderstandings. Whereas according to the second Lashon, he decided to remain, you know, in the Ma'ara forever. So how are we to understand Rav Kahana's response in the Gemara? A tragedy happened. Rabbi Yochanan's behavior resulted in the death of Rav Kahana. Does Rav Yochanan change as a result of that experience? Yes. He goes to seek forgiveness. He invites him back into the Beis Medrash. Rabbi Yochanan, the incredible godol that he was, took what he did. He did tshuva, I guess would be the best way to put it. He recognized that what we did was wrong, was misunderstanding. By the way, had he truly been laughing at him, I don't know if Rabbi Yochanan would have changed his mind. It's the right thing. But since, in the event, he wasn't laughing at him, he did tshuva, and he try to reconcile, and he got the code, and he opened the cave, right? So Rabbi Yochanan changes and grows as a result of this. What about Rav Kahana? Does Rav Kahana change as a result of this encounter? So according to the first Lashon of Rashi, right? Let's focus on the second Lashon of Rashi for the time being. He insists on remaining dead. Like, what does that mean? How do you read that? Why would he insist on?
Was he actually alive?
It's hard to know, and that's a very good point.
Then he would just go through death again.
Because if you look at the next plus the piece of Gemara, it also says Tyre, he woke him up. So maybe he was in some kind of never land state where he was neither completely dead nor completely alive. I don't know. Because later, the next line of Gemara says Tyre, he woke him up, Ukme, and he got it to continue.
So logically, because his option is, if, you know, either take me with, I'll go with you and I'll stay alive, otherwise I don't want to go through death again. Staying there, he won't be alive, he'll go through death again. So it doesn't really make sense.
Yeah, exactly. But on the other hand,
that's what I'm saying, he had to have not been actually fully alive.
Right, so normally we don't recognize a state which is neither dead nor alive, and, you know, either you're dead or you're alive, normally. But on the other hand, he's conversing with him, And by the way, I'm going to step back and try to explain this whole thing in a broader canvas, but now we're just kind of in the trenches, in each line by line. But in the trenches and line by line, on the one hand, he's having a conversation with him, so there must be some element of resurrection or some element of life. So what he's saying, he doesn't want to become alive again. And then right after that, look at the next word, tyre. He woke him up. Ukme, I'll read it so that you see the whole thing. He got up. Shaila kol sveka de havale. Rabbi Yochanan asked Rav Kahana every shaila that he didn't know. Rabbi Yochanan, a lot of things Rabbi Yochanan didn't know. All of us, you know, even Rabbi Yochanan had shailas. You know, the machlokas, there were issues he didn't know. So he had Rav Kahana for a few moments, still alive. So he asked him every shaila he had. Upashtinu nele, and he answered every single question. And then that ends the immediate story. And then the Gemara has a little coda conclusion to the story, which I think is sort of, I don't know if it's added afterwards, but it's not the story itself, but it's the Gemara's comment on the story, the Baal Agadita's comment on the Agadita he just told. Hainu de'amar Rabbi Yochanan. This is what Rabbi Yochanan said, and he apparently quoting a statement of Rabbi Yochanan. Dilchon amre, you think that all of our Torah learning is yours, that means you, my Bnei Yeshiva, my Talmidim in Eretz Yisrael, Dilhonhi. It's all Bavel. See, look at Rashi. Rashi explains it. Shalachem ha'isi omer Torah shal Bnei Eretz Yisrael, Dilhonhi shal Bnei Bavel. It's really Bnei Bavel. Okay, I think that's very, very significant, which I will return to in a minute. But the exact status of Rav Kahana's situation is unclear. Is he talking to him? Is he dead? He's not dead. But that's, I think, a part of the mystery of this piece of the Agadah, and is very, very mysterious. But let me return to the question I asked you before. Do you think Rav Kahana changed as a result of this encounter with Rabbi Yochanan and death and re-encounter with Rabbi Yochanan in this mysterious cave blocked by a serpent? So look at, based upon the Lashonos of Rashi, could you try to answer that question? Yes?
I can hear it going both ways. It seems that he has gone through some kind of a transformative experience. He did sit for all those weeks or days in the shir, whatever it was, getting pushed down, and it was kind of...
I think it was one shir.
Whatever it was.
An hour, or whatever it was.
It was very traumatic for him.
Right, yes.
And... Right. And he said, you know, I guess I should accept it, you know, as though this is my exile of silence that I have to do. So we see that he definitely responded to it. It's, you know, what, it definitely wasn't an experience that just passed him by. But if he's saying, I don't want to ever be killed again, and I don't know if killing means he was embarrassed or rejected, whatever the killing, what the nature of the death was, I don't want to experience it again. That could be saying it was just very unpleasant for me, and you know, I've learned from it, and I don't want to have to experience it again. Maybe I'll be different now.
Okay,
I'll handle it differently. You could also read it that he's saying, you know, I don't know if I ever want to have to be lowered again.
Okay, and so we don't really know. That's what you're saying. But yeah. I want to focus, and I take your point. Focus specifically for a moment on the first Lashon of Rashi, the Mendi Lashon. We'll call it that. He doesn't want to go back in the Beis Medrash because he's afraid that Rabbi Yochanan will kill him again. Why is he afraid Rabbi Yochanan will kill him again?
Killed him one time.
What's that? Killed him one time, but what does it tell you about Rav Kahana's assessment of his own self-restraint?
He's going to do the same thing again.
Yeah, he's going to do the same thing again. In other words, Rav Kahana seems to be saying, look, this is going to be a case of deja vu all over again. In other words, I did it once, I offended Rav Yochanan, and he got really angry or got very upset, and I died. And he recognizes that his style is such that this is likely to happen again, and there's likely to be a further negative encounter with Rav Yochanan. Rav Yochanan is likely to get offended another time, and he's likely to die again, which is to say that Rav Kahana, on the one hand, accepts his limitations, understands that he is incorrigible. Rav Kahana is Rav Kahana. He's not doesn't believe himself capable of assuming a more modest, passive role. He knows who he is, and he's not going to change. And that's why he's afraid to go back into the yeshiva with Rabbi Yochanan, because if he's not going to change, Rabbi Yochanan might end up killing him again. So, on the one hand, Rav Kahana is saying, I can change, which means that he hasn't changed on this reading. But on the other hand, he's recognizing his own limitations. And that is an element in self-awareness and acknowledgement of weaknesses. And that is the first step towards tshuva, the first step towards what are the processes of tshuva? What's the first step in tshuva? Yes, moda ala ova, that he did something. Now, Rav Kahana admits, you know, this is who I am, and it ain't great, and it might result in another death. Now, he could say, I should try to change. There's harata ala ova v'kabbala ala asid. Right? So, in effect, Rav Kahana is admitting to his weaknesses and limitations because... couldn't he control himself so he doesn't anger Rabbi Yochanan? Answer, he admits that he couldn't, according to the Mendi Lashon and Rashi. He admits that he couldn't. And nevertheless, he recognizes that he's not a makabel al asid. He can't make himself better.
It's not possible, though, that he's really saying that Rabbi Yochanan...
So you all see what I'm saying? That on the one hand, that whereas Rabbi Yochanan really... significantly evolves and changes as a result of this, Rav Kahana undergoes a limited, on this first lesson of Rashi, I think, partial evolution, but he recognizes that he's not going to be able to go all the way. Yes?
Is it possible that he's saying, Rabbi Yochanan's going to continue to misunderstand me?
Possible. Why can't he just, like, look, there are a bunch of Talmidim in the yeshiva. He doesn't kill them. Right, he doesn't get angry at them. So can he learn to go along and get along?
Rabbi Yochanan thought he was smirking at him.
But now he knows that it's not a smirk. Oh, thank you, that's a good word. Rabbi Yochanan knows he's not smirking, but he's a... Rabbi Yochanan had little tolerance for the aggressiveness that Rav Kahana displayed with the lowering of the pillows and the up. And... He felt it likely he would offend, not verbally, not with a smile, Rabbi Yochanan, he felt he couldn't change. So on the one hand, it's, I think, a harata al-avar, recognizing this is not a good situation, but saying, I can't change.
Yeah, I hear that. I just think there's room for that, because we established that if Rabbi Yochanan had not thought that he was smirking, then he wouldn't have killed him.
We didn't establish it. We established Rabbi Yochanan said that. Okay. Rav Kahana himself may have not...
So Rav Kahana saying that this is something that Rabbi Yochanan and I will never meet eye to eye on.
Right. Okay. That's a reading. That's a possible reading. We don't really know.
It could be self-limitation. It could also be limitation.
In Rabbi Yochanan. Yeah. It could be. Yeah. In Achanan. That could be too. We don't have much evidence here, but whenever something major like this happens in a person's life. Anything happens in our lives, we need to reflect about the impact it has on us. And do we change as a result of that? And that's why I'm raising the question. Rabbi Yochanan does. I'm not sure if Rav Kahana does. And if Rav Kahana does, it's only in a very modest way, limited way. And here's my point. I'll tell you what. Here's the point I want to leave you with. That Rav Kahana had more Torah knowledge, but less godless. Rav Yochanan had more godless, but in comparison to at least aspects of Rabbi Yochanan's brilliance, less so. So you can be great in ability to argue a svara and knowledge, but have a little less wisdom, and that would be Rav Kahana in comparison to Rabbi Yochanan. They were all greatly great wise men, obviously. I'm just comparing the two. Whereas Rabbi Yochanan seems to have, he asked Rav Kahana all the shilas, right? So Rav Kahana seemed to have surpassed him in knowledge. But nevertheless, Rabbi Yochanan is the Gadol. He was the Gadol Hadar. Rav Kahana was not the Gadol Hadar. Rabbi Yochanan was the Gadol Hadar in the broadest sense. When you come to a great Gadol or a posek, you want not only somebody who has total mastery of the halacha, you want somebody who is a Gadol in midos and in, you know, he's thought through and he's reflective and he's self-aware and he understands his limitations. I mean, you want, and that's Rabbi Yochanan. So, you see the complex way in which this agadita contrast these two great people. Yes.
Yeah. Because the Tenor of Kahana, maybe it wasn't like he was saying he has a chisar. Maybe he was saying, I'm not changing because I think it's the best way to do it. Meaning maybe he's just someone who believes that you should be attacking constantly, not that you should be like passively like, oh, it's nice. So therefore, he was like uncompromising. And then maybe that's also like, maybe Rabbi Yochanan came to acknowledge that. And that's why he said, like, we think we have Torah and like in our Yisrael, really it's in bubble where they're more aggressive. And I guess it would also fit well with like with Rish Lakish when after he died, he didn't like the people who were proving him right. He only liked the people who were proving him wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So like, great. Kahana wasn't saying I have a chisar.
It's a wonderful point. Wonderful point. And I'm going to actually build on that right now.
Oh, okay.
So that's a great point. And I think you're really on target, at least the way I understand things. So, this concluding coda of the Gemara, Dilchon Amrei Dilchon Hi, I think really illuminates the entire Agadata. Remember, I've mentioned this in the past, that the Gemara, I think it's in Sanhedrin, says that B'nai Eretz Yisrael are Mechablin Zeb Zeb Halacha, are Chovel Zeb Zeb Halacha, they're very aggressive in Bavel, whereas in Eretz Yisrael, they are Nochen Zeb Zeb Halacha. They're much more relaxed, tranquil, not as aggressive. Bavel was a very aggressive model of learning in the Beis Medrash. I mentioned this the last time. They argued and fought. Eretz Yisrael was less aggressive, less pugilistic. You know, they didn't go into the base and scream and yell at each other and, you know, shry until the end of the walls. You know, that it's more relaxed. And that's why, by the way, Talmud Bavli is much longer than Talmud Yerushalmi, because there were many more machlokas in Bavel than there were in Eretz Yisrael. And so Talmud Bavli is bigger because there was more to record, whereas Talmud Yerushalmi was shorter because there was less to record because there were fewer machlokas. Now, so Rav Kahana, it represents, you might say, the extreme version of Bavel, and he comes into conflict with the Eretz Yisrael model of learning of Rabbi Yochanan, which is, as I say, much less aggressive. And the key point to remember is that this Agadah takes place in one of the great transition periods in the Mesorah of Torah Shebaal Peh. The teacher of Rav Yochanan, Rav Chia, Rav Oshia, all the great Gdolim of that period, was Rav Yehuda HaNasi, the compiler of the Mishnah, who was based in Eretz Yisrael. HaNasi was based in Eretz Yisrael. So Rav had learned in Eretz Yisrael, Rav Chia, Rav Oshia, Rav Yochanan, of course, although he was a very junior, but they were all in the school of Rav Yehuda HaNasi. Then as a result of all kinds of persecutions and various developments, more and more Chachamim began to move to Eretz Yisrael. Rav was the leader of that, and Shmuel, and all of their Talmidim. And Bavel emerged as a competing center of Torah learning in the world. So you had these two competing centers, Eretz Yisrael and Bavel. Eretz Yisrael was declining because of difficult economic circumstances at the time and persecutions, and Bavel was commensurately growing. First, Rabbi Yehuda Maseira, I think, moved to Bavel, and more people moved to Bavel, and the yeshivas in Sura and Pumbedisa began to really, really expand under the leadership of Rav and Shmuel and their great, great Talmidim, even after they died, Rav Huna and others. And there is a shifting of the center of halachic authority in Jewish life during this period, and with different styles of learning. By the way, you see a similar tension in the period of the Rishonim. You have the Talmidim of Rashi and his whole school. They were nochen zeba zeba halacha. How frequently do you see Rashi asking kashas? He explains things. He's a parsha. Explains things. As his whole school, Safar de Berashi, the Chassidei Ashkenaz, they were nochen zeb zeb halacha. But as they were the regnant force, there came to be a whole new school, also in Ashkenaz, and that's Bali Tosfos. Kasha Teres, the Re, the Rabbeinu Tam, Kashas, you know, it's a whole different, they changed the whole world of Torah learning. Bali Tosfos transformed what it means to learn. And you had these bright young whippersnappers, so to speak, aggressive kasha teretz going to these like the great Talmidei Chacham, the Nochen Zeb Zeb Halacha of Rashi and Chassidei Ashkenaz, and they weren't just, what is this? All these kashas? Let's learn and learn and learn and memorize and memorize and memorize, understand, understand, understand. Balai Tosfos is saying, but there's a sugya here, and there's a sugya here, and there's a sugya here. How do we reconcile? It's a radical change in learning and in self-conduct, how you conduct yourself in the base matters. And that paralleled, 1,000 years later, what went on during the period of Bavel, the ascendancy of Bavel, and the decline, relative decline of Eretz Yisrael. And so what's going on here is Rabbi Yochanan is seeing Rav Kahana as they're usurping with the power of their kashas and teruchim and derech halimut the authority that rightfully belongs to Eretz Yisrael, ki mitzion teitzei Torah. And what Rabbi Yochanan is struggling with is Rav Kahana's methodology, his aggressive methodology, and his being is objection to it, and his insistence on the pure Mesorah of the Kedusha, of the Torah of Eretz Yisrael. And he sees a threat from Bavel. Bavel is a threat. It's not the school of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, it's a threat. And so Rav Kahana represents this larger threat that is shaking the foundations of how Torah is organized, how Pesach Halacha is organized in that period in Jewish history. And Rav Yochanan is very disturbed by that. And this whole encounter with Rav Kahana, where he eventually, Rav Yochanan comes to say, Dilchon Amrei Dilchon, he recognizes the power and the ascendancy of Bavel, but it's with a great deal of regret. Ki mitzion teitze Torah. It's not supposed to be that way. And he feels great pain, and that's part of the trouble. So now, with that larger frame in mind, I'm going to step back and suggest a way of thinking about this whole enigmatic encounter with the cave. I am not saying this is true. I have no idea if it's true. But I am throwing it out there for you to think about. And I'll tell you who my forebears are in this. They're the Ritva and Rabbi Avram ben Arambam. They don't comment on this Gemara to my knowledge, but they suggest in Derech with respect to other Agadotas, which I will apply to this Agadota, maybe wrongly. I don't know if it's right, but I leave it for you to think about. So let me read to you the Ritva, which I have here somewhere. Here we are. This Ritva appears, some of you may have encountered a very famous series of Agadotas in Bava Basra, Melchor Sesfina. The Gra wrote a whole parish on it. Aaron Feldman wrote a translation and explanation of that parish, the kettle and the something fish, something, I don't know. What is it called? The drum and the kettle, that's something.
Like that,
something like that, yeah.
Yeah,
Juggler
and the King?
What's that?
Juggler and the King.
There you go, okay. Right. Yeah, Juggler.
This is the other one.
Yeah, right. Okay, whatever. So he wrote. And Maral, many Gedolim have attempted to Kliyakar try to explain those Agadotas. But here's what the Akose, it's one of the Perishim to the Ein Yaakov, quotes the Ritva. So he quotes the Ritva as saying, I'm not going to read the whole part, but just the part that's relevant to me. V'yesh gam v'ma'asiyos elu, and there are, with respect to these stories told in the Agadota in Bava Basra, these events described in the Agadah didn't actually appear to the Amorayim who discussed them. They said, I saw this, I saw the ocean with the waves, you know, as big as the World Trade Center, and all these fish that were as gigantic as the whatever, you know, these incredible stories they told about what they saw in the sea. So he said they never really saw them. El b'mara chalom, it was in a dream. V'zeh ki k'sheh ha-chachamim holchim b'yam okainus, when chachamim traveled in the ocean, v'roim shon niflaos Hashem Yisbarach, they saw the great wonders of Hashem Yisbarach, v'gam shehem sham misbodedim m'chashvim b'nyonim naroim niflaos, so they would think and reflect, as every person would, and of course as a godol, what is the meaning and significance of this? What am I to make of these wonders that I see in the sea? Ube'es hashina, and when they are sleeping, Yirelehem ki inyan hirhurim inyanim nifloim morin al inyan. They had these visions in a dream of what they were thinking about as they reflected about the broader significance of what they saw. So what the Ritvas and the Rabbi Avraham ben Rambam says something similar. Rabbi Rambam says whenever they got it to say something that doesn't make any sense, it took place in a dream. I don't know if this took place in a dream, Rabbi Yochanan, but I would suggest that it kind of took place in a vision. I mean, the whole thing with the stake and opening and the code and getting the code right and this encounter with Rabbi Yochanan, is he dead? Is he not dead? Is he alive? He's not dead. We saw, it's hard to figure out exactly what's going on there. I want to suggest to you that this was a kind of a vision, like the Ritva might say, that Rav Yochanan had as he was struggling. I don't know if he was asleep or awake, but he was struggling with what happened with Rav Khan. It's a personal struggle. After all, it resulted in Rav Khan's death. But it's a broader struggle about where is the supremacy of Torah? Is it in Eretz Yisrael or is it in Bavel? And so he has this vision of encountering Rav Kahana in the cave and the dialogue between them and asking him all the sveikos. It's Rabbi Yochanan, on the one hand, resisting the supremacy of Bavel, killing Rav Kahana. And by the way, the Maral says he wasn't killed. There's the Maral here. He didn't literally die. He died mibchina sichlis, not literally. So again, I'm going with the Maral, that this is all a vision. It was Mibchina Sichlis. Rav Yochanan couldn't tolerate what Rav Kahana represented, which was the ascendancy of Bavel. And so he, in quotation marks, eliminated that model of Torah supremacy. It was a chalom, it was a vision. Maybe he's a chalom. This is what he's struggling with this. And so Rav Kahana dies for Rav Yochanan. I can't allow what Rav Kahana represents to override Ki Mitzion Teitzei Torah. I can't. But then he encounters Rav Kahana and he discovers through this vision of the snake that he really is the Talmud. And Bavel, the Rabbeim are in Bavel. That Bavel deserves its superiority. And he actually asks Bavel at Shilas. This is a vision or a halom in which, just as the Maral says, didn't literally take place, but it reflects the internal struggles that Rav Yochanan has with the changing centers of Torah learning, of Darkei HaLimud. Rav Yochanan devoted his entire life to Talmud Torah. And it's changing under his very eyes, represented by the Derech HaLimud of Rav Kahana. Devoted himself to Torah and Eretz Yisrael, and that was relative to Bavel fading away. It's very hard for him to deal with that. And in this chalom, in this vision, he's struggling with it. And in the end, now who, of course, tells the story? Which Talmud? Is this Talmud Bavli or Talmud Yerushalmi? Talmud Bavli concludes with the superiority acknowledged by Rav Yochanan of the Derech HaLimud of Bavel.